Good morning.
Good morning.
A special welcome to Joan-san and Michael-san. So this is the third talk on the Jewel Mirror Samadhi in October session. I gave the first talk, and Dokai talked yesterday, and so now we can probably never actually complete our study of it, but for this session, this will be the last one. So the first part of my section starts out like this. If you want to follow in the ancient tracks, please observe the sages of the past. One, on the verge of realizing the Buddha way, contemplated a tree for 10 kalpas. So what can we learn from the ancient stories? So there's many stories in our tradition of teachers doing extreme things in practice. Well, before they were teachers, when they were a student. They were very earnest in their desire to study and to practice the way and to understand. So there's many, many stories. I'll just mention a few. So there's the nun Rionin who scarred her face because she was told, "You're too beautiful." I think this is the story. She was told, "You're too beautiful to practice in the monastery. People will be distracted." So, you know, find another line of work. And instead she said, okay, if that's going to be a hindrance, I'll just fix that so that I can practice. Or Hui Ke cutting off his arm when Bodhidharma didn't believe his sincerity. Or even Dogen traveling all the way to China at a time where that kind of travel wasn't easy, but he felt, well, I need to understand something, so maybe I need to go somewhere where they, you know, I think maybe the true practice is being done, or I can learn something. So I don't think that these stories are to say we should copy them, you know, that, okay, now everyone go scar your face, or everyone go cut off your arm, or make a perilous journey. But please observe the sages of the past, their earnest heart in wanting to practice. So can we cultivate that that heart? Can we cultivate that effort and that intention? I also think we can look at not just the ancient past, but we can look at the recent past and contemporary people and learn from them. So how can we be inspired by contemporary teachers and leaders? So just thinking of a few, I think of Sister Chan Kong, who is in the Thich Nhat Hanh lineage. She's the she's kind of the second in seniority after Thay. And I read her memoir, and just so inspiring, her life of service and generosity. Just deeply entering into the Dharma and doing what was necessary to help beings. Or when I hear about the Dalai Lama having no anger toward China, you know, that's inspiring to me. That's a kind of a practice, that's a deep practice. Or recently, maybe a little more humorously, there was a priest at the Soto Zen Buddhist Association conference who was, we were talking about the SCBA standards or guidelines for membership, which were in a draft form and they still haven't been agreed upon because no one can agree. Like, is it 3-month practice period residential? Is it how many days of sesshin? Is it, you know, what are the minimum requirements for membership? So anyway, there's been a lot of discussion about that, and I won't get into the whole story, but anyway, one of the priests that I know kind of was talking about, sort of advocating for setting the bar higher, like having a real standard that people can go for that maybe is a little bit difficult. And she said, you know, if I had been asked, I would have lived in a monastery for a year or had a tattoo of Bodhidharma put on my neck, you know. So I think it's that kind of attitude of just, I'm going to do whatever it takes. And to me, it's like considering and remembering people like this in order to refresh our practice. Like for me, that's what it can do. Not to make me feel bad if my life circumstances are such that I can't actually do some of the things that the inspiring people have done, but what can I do? So that's where our observation of the sages of the past or the present can be helpful. I'm not going to tell the story of the one on the verge of realizing the Buddha way, contemplating a tree for 10 kalpas, but I think you can kind of get what that is, just the willingness to sit and practice for however long it takes. Which kind of relates to the next line as well, which is like a battle-scarred tiger, like a horse with shanks gone gray. So for here, I think remembering our own efforts. So we might, if we've been practicing for a while, we might remember, I used to do that. I used to practice like that with that energy. So can I keep going? Maybe the energy changes, but can I keep going? Can the heart of that practice be maintained? And it's interesting, the battle-scarred tiger. So sometimes practice can be kind of like a battle. It's a challenge. And we need to be willing to be in it for the long haul. So just keep going, not counting the years, and yet staying fresh and engaged. So there's another translation of these lines that's very different. So this was in the book that Dokai referenced also by, is it Dale and Barbara Verkuylen? So in their book, the translation is, like a tiger leaving part of its prey, a horse with a white left hind leg. That's very different than a battle-scarred tiger or a horse with shanks gone gray. So battle-scarred tiger, you think of like, okay, it's an old tiger. He's been in a lot of battles. He's got some scars. And then there's the old horse turning gray, you know, putting him out to pasture. But now we have this, a tiger leaving part of its prey, a horse with a white left hind leg. So the Verkuylen say in this, it would be like kind of going against the grain. I mean, a tiger does not usually leave part of its prey. So this is like in practice where we kind of do the thing that's not, doesn't necessarily come naturally, like staying with our suffering. That doesn't really come naturally. Just like a tiger wouldn't leave part of its prey behind. A tiger would go for, you know, eat as much as a tiger eats and then leave the scraps for the hyenas, but the tiger wouldn't leave like the choice meat. So just like that, we do something different in our practice, something unique. And it's noticeable, just like you would notice a white left hind leg of a horse that's, you know, maybe just gray and sort of a dull color, but then there's this flash of white. I kind of like the battle-scarred tiger and the horse with shanks gone gray better. But on the other hand, there's some some teaching in the other translation as well. Next we have, because some are vulgar, jeweled tables and ornate robes, because others are wide-eyed, cats and white oxen. So these lines are really about skillful means. So for the coarse and uncultured, we have finery, tea ceremony, orioki. So we could say for those who are uncomfortable with forms, then we have a lot of forms. But for those who are starry-eyed, then let's remind them of the simple, ordinary things to help them return to earth. So putting oatmeal in the lovely orioki bowl, something very simple. Cats and white oxen, something that, you know, you would see every day. We probably don't see white oxen every day here, but at this time, that was like a really common thing to see, like just a plain oxen, just a plain cat. So this is how practice works. Like, we take the medicine that we need. And it's also, I think, how the functioning of thusness or suchness works. So, for example, the wide-eyed will probably not have less of a chance, maybe, of encountering thusness in the stars, but they might find it in a cat. And the cat lovers and the practical down-to-earth people probably need to look at the jewels and the stars. And then that awakens something. And of course, thusness is everywhere and can be found everywhere. So it's not really limited. So sometimes the starry-eyed find thusness in the stars. And the down-to-earth people find it in the earth. But in this practice, if you've encountered it for even a little while, you know that it tends to be a practice that does some things to sort of shake you up, doesn't let you just go along with your usual way. With his archer's skill, Yi hit the mark at 100 paces, but when arrows meet head on, how could it be a matter of skill? So I'd like to read a passage from this book that I mentioned the other day by Taigen Dan Leighton, Just This Is It. I'd like to read a passage where he talks about these phrases. The image of arrows meeting head-on is also used in Shito's Harmony of Difference and Sameness, which we're not chanting in this session, but we often do chant in session or in the morning. This image of the arrows meeting head-on represents a total engagement and integration with suchness, or with the phenomena fully meeting phenomena, such that it goes beyond even the remarkable worldly skill of a legendary archer. In Harmony of Difference and Sameness, this event is compared with box and lid fitting. This matching relates to the theme of teacher and student totally meeting, as well as a perfectly appropriate statement of reality, or a complete accord with the affirming mind. So there is a skill. It's not that there's no skill, but we engage the skill, we engage the practice, and then when the meeting happens, it's not a matter of skill then. In that moment, it's not a matter of skill. We've brought forth our best effort and then we let go. And then engagement unfolds, thusness is realized. So it's not like if we were an archer that then, okay, we give up practicing archery or we give up practicing zazen. So we do that, but then we know that there's a limit to the development of skill and what that can bring us. The wooden man starts to sing. The stone woman gets up dancing. So, in a way, this phrase kind of harkens back to a phrase earlier in this song, in this poem, which is, at least it reminds me of the wondrously embraced within the complete, drumming and singing begin together. So, I think of the wood of the drum and then the singing. Here we have the wooden man starts to sing, the stone woman gets up dancing. When we talked about this particular phrase in the Teacher Ryo group earlier this week, Myo-o, who's part of our study group, talked about how these two things are always in life. Like everything that's alive has a pulse. So we can think of for in our bodies, it's a heartbeat. And well, actually, we could say everything has a pulse because there's even a pulse of a stream flowing or the pulse of waves coming into the shore. So there's a all everywhere there's a pulse, and then there's harmonics. So then there's the overlay of the pulse. The melody or the life that flows around the pulse. So really the wooden man starts to sing, the stone woman gets up dancing, the pulse and the harmony. This is our life. This is what it means to be alive. That's the pulse and the harmony, but here we have a wooden man and a stone woman, so we have these seemingly dead things. They're not alive, but they come alive. So, what does that mean? So, what it reminds me of is the teachings of the insentient from Dogen, and particularly in the Mountains and Rivers Sutra. So, here in this phrase, the wooden man starts to sing, the stone woman gets up dancing. We kind of have a preview of Dogen's worldview in which everything is alive. The whole universe pulsing and singing with life. So I have a special connection, I feel, with the Mountains and Rivers Sutra, or sometimes called Mountains and Waters Sutra. I studied this at Zen Mountain Monastery like right before I was ordained. It was like in less than a year before I was ordained. I spent a month there. And that was like the overall thing that we were studying. That was the overlay. We had within that month, we had a week of like intensive study of this particular sutra, and we also had a sesshin. And then we were studying it, and the other times too. But other people would come in. You know, some of us were there for a month, some of us were there for longer. But we were looking at the sutra the whole time. And our assignment for those of us who were there for the whole month, in particular, was be something other than human, and express the Dharma from that. So, in other words, connect, become. something either insentient or non-human, and then also express, so make art or write a poem or do something, a performance or, so, and then some of us would have, be selected to, like, there would be sort of a talent show at the end. So I chose a rock. And I thought maybe I didn't want to, like, put what I would do, but I thought maybe I would, like, do a drawing and or write a poem. That would be the thing that I would do. But I was really determined to let the rock speak to me or become the rock. And it wasn't just a particular, it was like rock. So I walked around, and it's in a beautiful setting. So there's many rivers and rocks and mountains. So rock was around a lot. But it was impossible. It was like a koan. It was really impossible to do the assignment. In my free time, I was sitting with rocks, looking at rocks, walking on rocks. The rocks have no words. What would they say? And how could I let go of myself and my ideas about the rocks? So I just had to kind of give up, actually, and say, well, this is impossible. And then there was some connection. I think I was trying to enter it from my logical mind, and then really, and rocks don't have that same kind of logic, so they weren't cooperating. But in the end, I got something, and then I did write a poem. It was very short, 2 lines. Here it is. It's not that rocks don't turn to sand. It's just that they don't worry about it. That was it. So I wasn't chosen for the talent show. But that was okay. I felt it was a great teaching from the rocks that I felt in my bones. So even though the expression was small, I felt something very peaceful and solid just from that, immersing myself in the effort for the month. And since my Dharma name, Sosan, has mountain in it, which is rock, I was glad that the rocks could teach me something. The wooden man starts to sing. The stone woman gets up dancing. So Taigen reminds us that this line is evocative of spring arising. So it's a metaphor often used in Zen. So we have the, like, wooden trees, no leaves, no sign of life. They seem to be dead, and then they burst into life. Or the landscape seems to be barren, seems to be stone, and then wildflowers in the spring. Another thing around this line, and this is probably my favorite line in the whole section, so I'm going to talk about it a lot. Taigen also reminded me of the story of the dragon singing in the withered tree. So the dead tree. And that's the same imagery, like something seemingly dead, a withered tree. Then there's a dragon song or a dragon howl that comes from that. And I do, with that story also, I have a particular fondness. So I'd like to share the story, information about the dragon and the withered tree, so the old story, and then I'd like to share my story, which is also old, but more recent, 10 years or more, rather than hundreds. So let's see. So this is from Sounds of the Valley Streams, which is 9 translations of the Shobogenzo. And by the way, I just have to say, I love this the cover of this book because every time I see it, it's Sounds of Valley Streams. But every time I see it, I don't see that. I see SVS, Oat, Ulrur, Dia. My mind's wanting to read it across. And so I love that because it surprises me every time I look at it. So here's the story of the dragon and the withered tree. And this is from Ryūjin, which is dragon song or dragon howl. And it's also Myō-ō's way name. Once a monk asked great master Tsi Tang, "What is the way?" The master replied, "A dragon singing within a withered tree." The monk said, "I do not understand." "An eye twinkling within a skull," replied the master. A monk once asked Shi Shuang, "What is the dragon singing within the withered tree?" The master answered, "You are still involved with pleasure." "What is the eye twinkling in a skull?" asked the monk. Said Shi Shuang, "You are still stuck in ordinary consciousness." Now, there's a very different translation of those last two that I want to read because I think it's informative. And this is a from Taigen, who I really respect his translation. So when I say I like it better, I also have the, know about his scholarship here. So here's his translation. Later, a monk asked Shi Shuang, who, by the way, Shi Shuang is a successor of Yunyan's brother Dao Wu. So Yunyan, who is Dungshan's teacher. So we have like a connection actually to the Jewel Mirror Samadhi here, written by Dungshan. Anyway, for people interested in that kind of thing. Later, a monk asked Shi Shuang, "What is a dragon singing in a withered tree?" Shi Shuang responded that it still holds joy. That's really different than saying you are still involved with pleasure, which seems to be a shaming, like you're still involved with pleasure. Stop it. Instead, it still holds joy. What is the dragon singing in a withered tree? It still holds joy. When asked about the eyeball in the skull, Shi Shuang said that consciousness remained. So rather than you are still involved with ordinary consciousness, what is the eyeball in the skull? Consciousness remained. Anyway. So here's just a few more lines about the, this goes on, these, this, the conversation through the centuries about the withered tree goes on. A monk once asked Tungshan, who was Dungshan's successor, a monk once asked Tungshan, "What is the dragon singing within the withered tree?" Tungshan answered, "The bloodline is never severed." So that could refer to the transmission of the Dharma. "What is the eye in the skull?" asked the monk. Tungshan said, "It is bone dry, but not completely spent." The monk said, "I still do not understand. Is there anyone who can hear the song?" Tungshan answered, "There is not a single person in the world who does not hear it." The monk persisted, "I still do not understand. Are there any words to explain the dragon song?" Tungshan replied, "I do not know what the words are." So my story about this, and maybe Kyoku will remember this because I think you were in my group. So we did, we when we were studying this, actually using this book and studying some of the essays in here, we also kind of had an assignment over the course of the class, too. I think we were either assigned certain lines or certain essays, or we could pick. And there were small groups. This was a class at Claus and Water in, I don't know, probably, I don't remember if it was before or after Seamus, my son, but it was somewhere like way back, in the way back. Anyway, the group that I was in was four women, and we picked the dragon singing in the withered tree to somehow like become and digest and express. And this is what I remember about what we did. We got giant butcher block paper, bigger than that sheet, like wider than that sheet, and like 10 feet long. And we made outlines of our bodies. And then I think we made like them bigger, like tree branches coming from our head, like the withered tree. But it was actually our bodies, our four bodies that were the, you know, the template for the tree, like the trunk. And then the branches came out. And then we had the posters up like along, you know, the front of the room, and we sat zazen kind of on cushions in front of them. And then we took turns asking the questions like, what is the dragon singing in the withered tree? And let me read some of the, so you can get the idea. Or what is the way? A dragon singing within the withered tree. I do not understand. An eye twinkling within a skull. What is the dragon singing within the withered tree? You are still involved with pleasure, because this is the translation we used. What is the eye twinkling in the skull? You are still stuck in ordinary consciousness. What is the dragon singing within the withered tree? The bloodline is never severed. What is the eye in the skull? It is bone dry, but not completely spent. I still do not understand. Is there anyone who can hear the song? There is not a single person in the world who does not hear it. I still do not understand. Are there any words to explain the dragon song? I do not know what the words are. Then we sat, and then like one by one we got up and went and stood like in our tree, so like we stood in the trees, and then we started keening is the best word. So that kind of it's from Irish like grief, but it was a sound, it was a howl. It started really soft. I won't do it, but I'm just because it needed all four of our voices actually. It started really soft, just like coming from the gut and coming up and like coming up a tree and coming up the branches. And it just was this sound with no words. And then it kind of died down. And then we got back, one by one, got back down and sat zazen. That's how I remember it. Do you remember that, Kyoku? No? Not at all. Oh, that's okay. I couldn't remember if you were actually in my group or not, but maybe you weren't even in the class. So why am I bringing up that story now, other than there's a withered tree and a wooden man connection? But I think it's because I kind of miss that sort of energy. But I also feel like it's coming back. So particularly here at Clouds and Water, with all the preparations that are going on for the Bearing Witness retreat and the keening, the grief that we experience as we listen to the cries of the world and listen to the cries of our Native American brothers and sisters and witness and remember and correct the history of suffering. You know, that we had the wrong, we didn't know about it, and now we're hearing about it. So there is this way in which I feel like people are starting to, well, it's not like people weren't wholeheartedly engaging with practice before, but now there's a kind of harmonics, there's a sound, there's a singing energy that's coming forth. And, you know, whether we do that as part of Bearing Witness retreat, here, elsewhere, wherever we are, wholehearted engagement is very important. There also is the, when we engage, often we try to reach it. So there is that energy of kind of going forward, like me trying to hear the rock, trying to be the rock, my energy going forward. We want to jump into suchness. So Dungshan reminds us, it is not reached by feelings or consciousness. How could it involve deliberation? So I love this from Dale and Barbara Verkuylen. They say, we come to Zen with our heart and mind accustomed to pulling the petals off the flower in an attempt to understand its true nature. So that was like me on the rock, you know, just going at it in a way that's not quite right and not really helpful. It's not the way. But I think about that performance art piece that I described, and I think why that worked is we let the story move us. So like everything that we chose, maybe it was an idea, someone had an idea. Well, let's, you know, trace our bodies and have them be trees, and let's sit zazen, and let's do this and that. But really it was beyond the story of it. And I think because other than the words from the fascicle, we didn't use any words of our own. So we just answered with our bodies and in wordless song. So I think that also is, it is not reached by feelings or consciousness. How could it involve deliberation? We had some deliberation, like who's going to sit where, and that, you know, but then we gave that up. Just like in Sishin, we have, okay, here's the forms, here's, you know, where we're going to bow, this is how we're going to exit, this is where we're going to stand. But then when we are doing it, hopefully, we stop deliberating and we just engage. I think it is not reached by feelings or consciousness. It's like Dokai's story of walking out of a funeral home on a bleak March day and suddenly opening to something beyond, something luminous. Next we have, ministers serve their lords, children obey their parents. It's kind of like a clunker. So Taigen writes that this is coming from the Confucian values of obedience in a feudalistic and patriarchal culture. So we have some other values now. It's not like we don't value respect and obedience, but we value also the importance of leaving home and separating from one's parents at least long enough to establish our own identities. And we might rightly reject blind service and obedience to power and authority without reflection. So there's that. But the ministers and lords can also be thought of as host and guest. So that's where ministers serve their lord. It's like a host serving his or her guests. So it's just respectful and natural what happens. Someone comes into your home, you serve them. And this line about children obeying parents can also be thought of, so it's not like we're children and we should just obey, but it could be thought of like the rules that we all follow to get along harmoniously, like stopping at red lights and paying the bill at a restaurant after we've eaten. You know, so it's like just doing what's required to get along in society. But I've always read these lines as a reminder to just follow the forms of practice, not in a stupid, mindless way, but really engaging and letting go of my own ideas, letting go of my ego or inviting myself to do that. So it's harder now because I'm a teacher, so often I need to decide how things will be done, so then I have my idea. So, but I still have a chance to work on it, luckily. So it was very interesting being at the SCBA conference with all the teachers, all the different teachers. And like I remember, I noticed that the Eno decided a certain way to do, you know, a form, and it wasn't our way, and it wasn't the way of a lot of people, but, you know, we just did it. Actually, I was sitting next to Daigaku when the Eno was explaining, and he said, just like, not loud, but I could hear him, no, like, that's not the way. I turned to him and I said, well, it is here. And then afterwards, I had a very nice conversation with him. He's a wonderful resource for the traditional form, so I really appreciate that. And he even said later, he said, well, that was okay how Koan did that. That worked well. So it's very interesting. Also, this came up for me during the photo shoot, because we're standing, and you know, we've had this big ceremony, now we're standing, we get organized, it takes all this long time, and Bishal is taking the pictures, and then people had their cell phones like taking pictures, and I couldn't help myself. I said, how about we just, you know, all get a copy of the pictures Bishal is taking? And then Joanne looked back at me like dagger-eyed. And I was a little bit upset at first, and then I thought, no, that she's right. Not, you know, I don't have to insert myself here. And then also I started thinking, I don't know whose cell phones those are. What if it was like, oh, Jan Chosen Bays, or, you know, what if it was like one of the really senior people? So it's like, oh, okay, so it's good. I still can learn. So thank you. With practice hidden, function secretly, like a fool, like an idiot. So to me, this line is about humility. So being foolish in the sense of not worrying about what others think of you. Not worrying about your status. Or being carefree, like without worries. Or being willing to play with the children, like Ryokan. Being willing to say baba wawa or goo goo gaga to the babies. And also not, unless someone asks for the teaching, not giving it to them. So not like going home and, you know, sort of instructing your children and your partners and your parents and your cousins, brothers and sisters. Well, you know, unless they ask. Or sometimes there's a way in which you can say, well, there is a teaching about that. And then they could say, oh, I'd like to know. And then you can share it, but... You know, rather than saying, you know, really, you would suffer a lot less if you would just let go. It's probably not helpful. So you just practice secretly and help them secretly. Just to continue in this way is called the host within the host. So transcending host and guest, we have host and host. So here's where the activity of hosting goes in both directions. The Verkhailans say that the personal hosts the universal. So the personal receives the universal, serves the universal, receives suchness or thusness. So I think about that again, like Dokai walks out of the funeral home and boom, receives suchness. However, with continuous practice, the universal also receives the personal. So suchness receives you, and you receive suchness. And I think this is also called taking refuge in Buddha. And that's all I have to say, and we have a few minutes left. So again, I want to ask, now we have three teachers here, but I'd like to ask if Dokai has anything to add, and if Joan and Michael or anyone, if we have time, but we have only a few minutes, so we'll see. I'm stunned. All right. So, Joan or Michael, I want to give you first dibs.
I'm also committed.
Oh, okay.
Clearly the trend here. Thank
you. Well, Jack, then it's over to you.
I just had a question that sort of was right back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in all of them, the word samadhi was there. But it seems to me that in Dokai's rendering of it, maybe, well, as I read it anyways, it was dual your awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering what the connection between using the word awareness as a translation and samadhi.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think samadhi is a kind of awareness that's beyond our usual way of thinking about awareness. So that's why I don't actually see it as like a different, but you're right that kind of has a little different flavor when you hear the word awareness. So I think it's just that these words are hard to translate. I mean, as we saw by the horse with shanks gone gray or the horse with a white left hind leg. I mean, wow, that's really different. So do you have is something coming up for you around that?
Actually, I got confused. I think I wrote and said, I had some question about
which is this that we're talking about? Yeah.
What are we talking about? Because it was also said it was by Dokai.
Oh, yeah, that was a mistake.
Something, maybe this is another whole talk.
Huh.
Or Dogen's reinterpreting and putting another name on it, because that's a lot of them, just curiosity.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's as much as I know. That's Michael.
After, what is it, ministers serve their lords, children obey the parents, there's another couplet.
Not obeying is not filial. Failure to serve is no help. Yeah.
Right. So how do you understand that?
Well, really, I see that, and I just forgot to read it. I thought of it in the same way that when I talked about ministers serve their lords, children obey their parents. It's just what is harmonious, like following the forms of practice, following the rules of society so that we can live harmoniously. That's helpful to do that. So that's the way I see it. In what way does it catch you? You said it, that's caught you.
Well, there's a certain just practicality about it. You know, there's a lot of luminosity in the words for my ear. And that one's just a kind of
yeah.
a cut to the chase.
Yeah.
But don't just mess around.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Take care of the moment.
Yeah.
And if that means being filial or obeying your parents, see if you can't belly up to that bar.
Yeah.
You know?
Good.
And it doesn't necessarily, a story that comes to mind is of a young woman from the Tea Ladies, that Grace Shireson's book, who whose dad found her sitting on top of the Lotus Sutra. And I was thought, you know, that would be a good example of where it would be an appropriate non-filialness and a non-obeying. She was essentially demonstrating another insight into the emptiness, really, of the Lotus Sutra and sacredness.
I have a couple things to say, but I won't say that. I'll say this. Really, through the whole song, what stuck to me, and I think this was from one of Dokai-san's translations, about is call and response, in a way, inquiry and the response, and also with the two arrows meeting, it's like the effort you put forth. We don't see how it's answered, but it's always answered. It might not be what we think it is, but it's always, the effort we put forth is always brings forth something that's appropriate, that's in accord to the degree of sincerity we put forth, maybe. But and also with the wooden man stands up and sings, or the something.
The stone woman dances.
Yeah, and that also feels like responsiveness. Mm-hmm. And at the monastery, at Rumanji, it's very, I can see someone sitting very still, and it's almost like they're not even there. They're like wood or stone. And suddenly someone comes in front of them and bows, and they're right there.
Yeah.
And that always reminded me of that attentiveness and responsiveness.
Nice.
It's almost as if they're not even thinking about it. They're right there, and someone bows, and they'll just come back and bow. So that kind of attentiveness and responsiveness, not only among us, but the whole reality as a whole responds. So that all stuck with me throughout the whole song, call and response in a way.
Thank you. We're one more. We're over time, but we'll just do one more.
The wooden man starts to sing.
Mm-hmm.
Which reminds me of Pinocchio.
Yeah.
Which is also, I like that, because it's this deep wish to finally become real.
Yeah.
And he makes all these mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, oh, it's okay. You can be a real boy anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nice. Thank you, everyone.
May our intention equally penetrate every being in place with the true merit of Buddha's way.